Hey, this is Chase Barber.
And I'm Jordan Willey.
We're two blue-collar boys doing some blue-collar interviews. Okay, well, welcome to Blue Collar Interviews here. Today we got on Jace.
You almost said your own name.
I did. I read the wrong name on the screen. I read my own name, and I'm like, Jace. Yeah, we got Jace Bender and Chase Barber, so no way that's confusing.
Yeah, that ain't gonna screw anything up.
No. So, welcome. Thanks for coming on here.
Yeah, happy to be here. I was glad we were finally able to find some time.
Yeah, you bet. So you're an aircraft mechanic, eh?
Yeah, I actually, one of my jobs, I guess, is full-time. I'm a life flight mechanic for a helicopter company.
What's that, a life flight?
So when they have bad car accidents and stuff, they send a helicopter to go save people.
You're the mechanic for that?
I'm the mechanic for that.
Oh, that's pressure.
That's an important one to be.
Yeah, it's super fun. When I'm not at work, I'm on call. So I've been doing that now for about 15 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I'd be nervous for that one. Like, being the helicopter pilot's one thing, being the guy to make sure the helicopter is good to go up in the air. Ooh.
Yeah, I always tell all the crew, I said, don't piss me off. We could always make it look like an accident.
It's funny because it's a joke, but then give them a little serious stare. And
yeah, it's a little bit of dark humor for them.
a bit of dark humor.
I imagine, like, with a normal aircraft, you know, helicopters, like, oh, well, I'm still doing maintenance on it. It's not ready. They'll just be like, oh, okay, whenever she's fixed.
Yeah.
I imagine if it's a little different, if you're like, hey, just so you know, if it's not ready, somebody's going to die.
Well, not entirely. I mean, we do a lot of patient transfers, just hospital to hospital. And there's there's six other helicopters in the state. So if I'm out, the next nearest one's about 100 miles away.
Oh, okay. That's not bad.
It ain't there. We do a lot of, since we can only fly in good weather conditions, like if it's icy rain and that kind of stuff, we can't fly in it. So I do a lot of maintenance during those kind of.
Yeah.
I get the weather game a lot.
I guess like a lot of bigger cities still have still have helicopters going to save people. But it's more, I'd say it's probably more popular for rural people because like someone like me, like I'm 3 hours away from an actual like trauma hospital. Like,
yeah.
Brandon, what the biggest city I'm closest to can help me maybe patch up something, but actual heavy surgery has to go to a city 2.5 hours away.
Well, that's what we've got. We got a lot of rural clinics, you know, just kind of, they'll bandage you up till somebody else can get there and haul you to a bigger hospital.
Yeah.
Oh, so is that where the patient transfer comes in then?
Yeah, that's the patient transfer stuff.
Actually,
that makes sense. I was wondering, I'm like, a patient, I was just picturing, like, well, we gotta send, you know, he's in this. we gotta send Gladys down to the care unit. She's moving into,
you know, we do transfer a lot of senior citizens, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Just for like, well, they end up with heart conditions and things like that, and you know, and their standard clinic can't handle that kind of that level of issues, so they'll call the helicopter in, and you know, the whole thing we're doing is speed. It's just we're fast.
Yeah. No, this is actually kind of interesting, Chase. When you were working on your audio, me and Jace got talking, and he actually, like, he had bought a plane in Manitoba. So, of course, Manitoba being a small town as it is, I asked, oh, like, who was it from? I probably know them. And sure enough, I did. It's from a place in Minnedosa, actually, like, where I live. That's where he bought a plane from.
You're doing that Canadian Manitoba stereotype justice. You're
like, there it is.
I bought a plane from a guy in Manitoba, and you're like, oh, that's probably my neighbor. A plane he sold a little while ago. I remember that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, geez, I know Ken's selling some planes. He's like, yeah, Ken Kane.
I bought his last one, actually.
Yeah, he's been selling for a while because he sold his company a few years
back. He sold his business about 5 years ago, and he's trying to sell off the higher time airplanes, and he was having a little trouble with it. It's not your standard air tractor, so it's got a Czechoslovakian engine on it. It was originally a radial engine, so it had the big World War II round motor on it originally. So this is a conversion model, and they're a lot less desirable by a lot of guys. They like the Pratt & Whitney's.
If you don't mind me asking, like, what's a plane cost? Like, what'd you pay for it?
I got a, sadly, this is going to sound bad. I got a smoking deal at like $200,000.
Oh my goodness! I don't know what plane.
Wow, that's a lot. Okay,
I thought you were like talking like used unwanted plane. Like I thought we were talking
this
like
is
30
yeah, miles. It's a 1995 with about 5,000 hours on it.
Okay, I do know that's pretty. Yeah, ooh,
and it's got about 2,600 on the engine, and the engine's good for 3,000. So, like, you couldn't. I went to Canada because I couldn't touch anything near that in the States. Like,
so
the closest thing I found
good
in
for 3,000?
3,000 hours, and then it needs overhaul.
Yeah, that's with helicopters, too, correct?
Helicopters, yeah, the engine, everything on a helicopter is timed. I mean, every single piece. Like, the tail rotor has a different time life than the main rotor. The engine's different than the transmission, the clutch system. So, everything's based off hours. I actually just got done last, what the hell was it, November here. Right before Thanksgiving, I tore the entire transmission system out of my helicopter and had to replace it.
So you have a helicopter too?
Well, the hospital helicopter.
Oh, I was like, man, what do you do for it? Jeez, you got
well,
make some
I've
money.
Got a helicopter in pieces, actually. It's just a little two-seat jobber, but I still have to put it together.
Can I come fly your helicopter?
Yeah, sure.
No, don't let Jordan fly a helicopter.
I have to.
I sound like I'm way more impressive than I am. Like
you do.
I buy all the stuff nobody else wants.
Yeah, that sounds like us.
Yeah, it's like identical, only in aviation. And when I grew up on the farm, and we farmed the same way. All of our equipment is like the tractors that nobody wanted, the planters that are outdated.
Hold on, it is not identical to buying equipment. Because you know what? I go out and I can buy an old Kenworth for like $4,000, hop in it, and I'm like, well, she might make her home. Yeah. I think so. Like, it's a little different when you're in a helicopter flying it up.
I've flown a few airplanes where we kind of like, yeah, I ought to get her home.
Oh,
like, I bought a personal four-seat airplane out of Michigan from a guy. And this thing looked like it came straight from Pablo Escobar. I mean, no interior, just tore up plane. And I jumped in it. She fired up, everything checked out, took off, and flew her back to Nebraska about 3.5 hour flight.
Oh, well, fair enough.
Yeah, just hope she works.
But it seemed good.
I like that with the maintenance of, like, it's just a time thing. Like, it could be fine still, but it's like, no, at this many hours, done.
Yeah, place. that's the headache with aviation because, yeah, this many. Now, there's different parts. Like, in my ag world, we're called Part 91 in the States here, and that gives us a lot more leeway. We don't actually have to follow the overhaul time, so we can kind of do some things on condition.
Okay, so, you know, I genuinely wonder – and this is just a thought I just had. I wonder how the planned obsolescence is in the aviation world. Because, like, when it comes to trucking, you can tell that they're just building parts now to fail. They just straight up design parts to fail. I wonder if you have that in aviation. It's literally built in with the FAA then, or whoever does the regulation.
The FAA actually dictates a lot of times for overhaul, and it's not so much exactly up to the engineers, but I wouldn't say so because aviation is so back in the Stone Age. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're using, it's from the 60s or the 40s, and it hasn't changed. Like the air tractor I'm flying is identical to almost to the brand new one that's made.
Well, I was looking at, like, how long is the Cessna? Is it the Cessna 2? Or, like, how long, like, the same model's been from the 60s to, like, now? It's, like, pretty much
the
same
Cessna plate. 172 came out in 1950, like, 52, something like that. And they still make it today.
Hold on, more or less.
The same airplane. Yeah.
So if they're still building the same airplane, basically, from the 50s, why the hell can't you go out and buy a P-51 Mustang? Like, if we're still going to just make 1950s, I want a Spitfire.
Why don't we make the cool ones, right?
Yeah. Nobody cares about a 1950 Cessna. I want a 1945 P-51 Mustang.
There's a company over in Germany just came out with a 3/4 scale all-carbon fiber P-51 Mustang.
Oh, no way. What's that?
Yeah. Right away? I think it's somewhere around that 150 or 200 grand mark.
Oh, that's not. Oh, we gotta go buy a plane.
Yeah, yeah,
it's reasonable.
It's in the experimental market, so they have a whole nother area in aviation called experimental aviation or home built. And there's companies, they build these kits. So you basically, you like buy a plane in a box and you put it together like a Lego.
Oh my goodness. I feel like I'd hire you to put it together.
I've got two of these experimental airplanes, actually.
How much money do you make? You're flexing on me.
It looked like no, you bought it off
Ammo. Well, all right, I'm gonna these yeah. two other airplanes that my dad owns with me. So we've done a lot of horse trading in the aviation world. We'd buy a plane, we'd buy a wrecked plane, we'd fix it, we'd sell it, and then we'd be slowly moving up. Like the Pablo Escobar plane, we bought that because I figured, well, we can change the radios, avionics, put an interior in it, fix the paint, tune it up, and then send her down the road. Just kind of slowly step up in the world of airplanes, because we're not rich by no means. Everything happens because most people put in like a 10-hour day, and like every other blue-collar guy, I put in a 14.
You know, that makes all the big difference. It's I do like what Elon Musk once said, where he's like, you got to do 16-hour days. He's like, every day, if you want to get ahead, because basically, if you got a guy working, doing 8-hour days, and you're doing 16, in 1 year, you basically did 2 years worth of work. Like, putting in those extra time adds on extra years. It gets you way farther ahead.
Yeah.
Actually, if you're using your hours wisely.
Well, I just saw the Dirt. It was a clip from the Dirt podcast, and they're talking about working. He's like, oh, like we had a 60-hour week. It was so efficient. It's like, oh, yeah, but like, could you have done it in 40 hours? Can you be that efficient? Let's just work. But then his argument was let's just work a 40-hour week, but do it as efficient. Like, no, be that efficient, but still work the 60 hours. That's what you get ahead.
You know what? Here's the deal. See, I don't mind working a holy crap ton of hours for myself. You know, if it's my business, I'm going to benefit from it. I'm going to work all day and night. I won't put in that kind of work for somebody else's business.
If I'm going to put in the work for somebody else's business, I better be getting paid big bucks.
And nobody's going to compensate you for, you know, spending 14-hour, 16-hour days every day of the week as it pays off in your own business.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, that's where I'll put the caveat. Like, I know I've got friends and other guys that'll be like, yeah, I work an 80-hour a week all the time. Yeah, but you work it for, you know, Joe Bob's big plumbing industry. So you've made Joe Bob a ton of money and you've given away your whole life.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons I started my company is I put in months of work and hours on this one job. I think I've told the story before, but months and hours of work on this one job. And I remember what the job cost. And it was like, that probably cost him $20,000 for me to do. And you made 10 times that, maybe more.
Yeah, well, that's what got me into, a crop dusting or aerial application, as the guys like to call it nowadays. I needed a change. I'm just about 40 years old now, and it's like, if I'm going to do something, I need to do it now. Mm-hmm. Or you just will keep turning wrenches on the helicopter. So right now I'm in the transition period, so I'm doing both.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's how you got to do it when you're starting out your own thing.
Yeah.
Well, I need the safety net. I can't go without a check right now.
It takes a long
time. Well, when you buy a few $100,000 planes.
I got lucky. I met a good banker. And if it wasn't for him, this wagon would have never started going down the hill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got a helicopter question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
We're about 15 minutes in. I just realized we forgot to do the thing we're supposed to do that we always – we got to say where the people can check them out first.
Yeah.
Oh.
So what is your TikTok handle there?
That's NE Flying Cowboy.
Like Northeast Flying Cowboy?
In Nebraska. So NE is short, is the abbreviation for Nebraska. Apparently, I have recently found out that nobody gets that.
I always thought it was like, I wonder where the, like, at first I was reading it as the New Flying Cowboy. And I'm he seems like he's got some experience here.
I've heard new, I've heard knee flying, and everybody's like, why knee flying? It's N-E for Nebraska.
Yeah. Haven't you seen his knees? This guy's got awful knees. Terrible.
Yeah, they are god awful.
Okay, you know anyone else from Manitoba? I knew the one person you knew so far.
That's the only guy I met was Ken. Okay. I drove up there, hung out with him for the day, and looked at his airplanes, and met his wife, went out to eat. I mean, he's super nice.
Where'd you go out to eat?
Oh, God. What is Cornerstone Grill? Cafe downtown.
Cornerstone Grill or RD's?
I think it was Cornerstone. That's funny.
Sorry. I'm distracted. Okay. I got a helicopter question.
Yeah.
I helicopter shop. Not that I have a license, but I helicopter shop. The Robinson R22s and 44s, they are notoriously bad, apparently. What is bad about them? Like, what makes them bad?
Everything.
But that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, they're really light made, is what I would say. And piston helicopters, like, that's my experimental helicopter that I own, is piston driven too. And piston engines don't live very well on helicopters. They're air cooled, they run really hot, and there's just a couple, they're just really built light. Like, I got my training in an R22, so I've got about 55 hours or so in an R22, and I don't want to fly one again.
So if I'm shopping for our helicopters, stay away from those.
Yeah, I mean, they're easy to get into. They're a budget friendly machine.
That's what I liked about
it. You can always sell them, but you got to be careful, because a lot of, like, the entire helicopter on those time out. So when you see a deal, more than likely the whole airframe is timed out, and you're going to change basically rebuild the entire helicopter.
Yeah.
You know, Jordan, there's only, if we're going to be helicopter shopping, there is basically only one helicopter that we're allowed to buy.
Is it like something that was in Vietnam?
Yes, an old Huey. Or as the Canadian Armed Forces call them, the Griffin.
There you go. Or, you know what? I always liked the Magnum PI helicopter, the MD-500.
Oh, that's a nice one.
That's a sweet machine. We got some Highline pole maintenance guys that show up with them every year here in Norfolk to run the power lines. And one of these days, I'm going to bug them and try to go flying with them. Sweet. See if I can get a little time. And when I've got a couple of crop duster buddies, they're flying old Bell 206s. And, you know, that those are really good machines. They're reliable. They're pretty decent.
Well, you know, I am just realized something to myself. I'm not mature enough to hear the word "I've got a bunch of crop dusting buddies" with my mind does not go to literal crop dusting.
Back to this. That Bell helicopter. What model was it?
206.
Bell 206. Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
It's kind of the predecessor to the one I work on at the hospital. The one I work on at the hospital is a Bell 407.
Okay. Also, I need to make it very clear to everyone listening to me, I cannot afford a helicopter. I just like to shop for them.
Yeah, neither can I, but they're really fun to look at.
Yeah, right? You like picture like, ooh, if I had the money.
Well, a lot of guys ask me, because I've got all this helicopter experience, why didn't I go into a helicopter for aerial application? That's what I said. It's just the maintenance for where I'm at. We're so open country, you can cover a lot more acres in an airplane than you can a helicopter. And when I did the math, it came out way better.
Yeah, for someone like you to get field to field and then the actual application and storage, we'd be way better.
Yeah, mine's a complete linear shop. So, I mean, I do all the maintenance. I'm the pilot. I'm the owner. You know, the only other guy I got on staff is my dad. He's my ground crew. So he loads my plane with chemicals, and we're running out of a grass strip at his farm.
Do you have another plane?
I've just got the one crop duster.
Okay, I was like, I have another a pilot buddy. I'm like, I'll send him your way, get you another guy.
I just sold my other one, actually. So last year was my official first season as an aerial applicator professionally, and it was a hell of a ride. I had a little Cessna ag truck. It had a 6-cylinder piston engine in it, and about 2.5-3 weeks into that really heavy corn run, the engine blew up. So that was a fun start of the year.
Oof. Not a good start.
No, I got
trying
lucky.
To start a business. Oof.
I got lucky. I made my last pass for the night. I was finishing up a field, and all of a sudden I noticed something on my windshield, just little specks. And I'm like, oh, I must have just flew through my spray. So I headed back to the airport for the night. And Landon and I got out, and I seen the oil dripping out from the belly of my plane. And
oh, wow.
That's bad. And I was, from what the engine shop told me, I was probably 10 minutes from a catastrophic failure.
Yeah. In a catastrophic failure with your engine, can you fly pretty well with no engine? Like, how's that work?
Well, it's basically, they call it dead sticking it. Mm-hmm. So it's pick a spot in front of you, because you're going to hit it.
Oof.
You don't, in a crop duster, they don't glide the best. So you're already not flying very high. Like, when we're flying field to field, we're maybe 500 feet over the ground.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty good height for ferrying airplanes back and forth. So if it quits, and if it quits on a pass, I mean, you're going down right where you are.
Oh, goodness.
That's why I stepped up to this turbine engine and bought this plane from Ken, because it's a lot more reliable.
Yeah, no, that's scary, because I know, I don't know, I'm not a helicopter pilot, but I was looking at shit with the helicopter, how you can use, like, your down pressure to still spin the wings and bring you down kind of gracefully.
Yeah, they call that auto-rotation.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about that, but I was, it's, really it's been a little while. It's fun, because, yeah, you're testing, don't you have to do it?
Yeah, when I was training, we did just a ton of them. Like, mostly what you're training when you're learning to fly helicopters is emergency procedures, and that's pretty much top of the list. Mm-hmm. Is auto rotation.
So just killing your engines.
Whoa. Yep, kill the engine and bring her to the ground.
That's scary. But the Robinsons, now that's one thing I was looking into. They're really bad. Like, because sometimes they're failure, finicky. They just blow apart.
Yeah, that's the hard part about the R22 with that auto rotate. You don't want to overspeed the rotor, and you don't want to lose your momentum of the rotor, because it bleeds off really fast, and there's no getting it back because there's just no weight.
Scary.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was entertaining to learn to fly it. Like, that's the only helicopter of that size that actually requires a type rating. So you have to get special training to fly the R22.
Yeah, yeah, that is sketchy. I was looking into that too. I don't know why I shopped so much. I was thinking about this, and I was like, oh, I just skimmed them, and now I'm like, man, I went into it for a few nights. Oh, ridiculous.
I love window shopping. I look at time that way.
Terrible.
I mean, I'm literally shocked. I'm sorry. I'm not a plane guy, so I'm having to, like, look, as I'm assuming a lot of people listening to us, I'm just Googling the things as you're talking about them, being like, cool. Oh, okay. Now I know what that is.
I'm typically not. Like, I just kind of like the idea of owning a plane or an helicopter here, but a lot of money.
I love the idea.
Well, and I didn't grow up in aviation. Like, you know, as a kid, anything that airplanes is not in the realm. I grew up, we farmed uncle's ranch. So I grew up horseback and chasing hogs and stuff. And I actually ended up in aviation maintenance, like being a maintainer, is just because my dad told me to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was graduating high school. I didn't know what to do. And he goes, well, why don't you learn to work on airplanes? You can fix everything else. Maybe you'll get paid for that.
Good point.
Yeah. And so then I ended up doing that. I worked on corporate jets for a while. And then I ended up back at a small airport. A friend of mine I went to college with ended up running this airport. He was the head mechanic. And he called me one day out of the blue and asked me if I wanted to come work with him. And I was sick of working corporate planes and working night shifts. So I quit the next day and went and did that. And then that's the job that led me to this hospital job, working on the Lifelight helicopter, was the guy who was in charge in Omaha, Nebraska, maintaining the helicopters, was in charge of the Norfolk guy. And he come into our shop one day just pissed off and mad, you know, saying how much he hated that mechanic. And I told him, I said, you know, why don't you just fire the guy and hire me? And 3 months later, he comes in the door. He says, I fired him this morning. Where's your resume?
Holy.
And that's how I ended up with the job.
Wow.
That's a pretty neat way to get a good job. Sorry for the other guy.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other guy was screwing up, so I guess, you know, you can't help nothing, and this is a job you can't really screw up at.
No, you got to be a little careful with that
one. And it worked out great for me, because now I've moved back home. I'm, you know, half hour from my parents' place, so I get a farm with Dad, maintain helicopters, and fly airplanes.
It sounds like a bitching time.
Yeah, it's a hell of a good time. The only reason I started flying, actually, is because my dad, he always wanted to be a pilot growing up. And he come to me one day, he goes, what would you think about getting your pilot's license? I said, Dad, I don't know how the hell we're going to afford it. He says, well, if we scrape up enough money, maybe we can buy the airplane, you fix it, and then we'll learn to fly it. And I said, okay, so we bought the first airplane on eBay of everything out in California.
Yikes.
And we took off. I took off with a friend of mine. He's an old Vietnam vet. And we flew out to California and looked this plane over and then flew it home. It was a 13-hour flight back home around the Rockies and everything. It was a blast.
Okay, that's a bold move, to buy a plane and then you'd be like, well, we'll fly 13 hours through the mountains.
Yeah, what the hell, you know, we went down the South Passage, so they ain't as high.
And in that first flight there, did he let you do any flying yourself?
Yeah, I flew quite a bit of it, actually.
Really?
Flying is easy. The only hard part about flying is the landing. Anybody can fly. I could throw you in an airplane right now and say, here, fly it. And just hold.
Okay, I might take a trip down there here soon.
Yeah, I mean, anybody comes, either one of you guys, come out here, I'll take you flying.
Oh, that'd be awesome. I'd absolutely take you up on that. I might do
this. Yeah.
Although, wasn't there like an airliner that crashed a while ago because they let the kid fly it?
I'm not a kid, Chase.
I don't know if I've heard that one yet.
Oh, no, there was like a commercial airline. It was like, oh, this, I guess it was quite a while ago, but the, I forget where it was, but like a large, like, you know, big Boeing, and the pilot let the kid, his kid fly it, and the kid just like nosedived into the ground, killed everyone on board. Very tragic story. But
I did see that. I didn't look into it, but I did see that somewhere.
That you'd have to pass a lot of safety alarms to get to that point.
Yeah, you'd have to nosedive it pretty quick.
Well, you're gonna have to put airplanes don't exactly like to nosedive. Like you got to force them to do it. So that kid must have like just stuck his feet on the controls and held them forward.
And like you think that somebody would have what did he do? Put a 6-year old in charge and then go to the washroom? Be like, you got a kid. I gotta go take a leak.
I gotta get a cup of coffee, man. Just keep her pointed dual north. We'll be all right.
Hold on. It was in Russia.
Oh, that explains everything.
Now it all makes sense.
Yeah, Aeroflot flight 9593. Let his 16-year-old son go on the controls. It wasn't even a kid. It was you just let his 16-year-old do it, and you're like, all right.
I grabbed.
He was interning.
You steer plane.
Yeah.
Okay,
that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes all a lot more sense now.
Yeah. Speaking of sketchy planes, my brother works up north, and he flies in, flies out. And they were on the runway one day, and there was quite a delay. And on the intercom, he's a mechanic up north. They go, is there a mechanic on board? They call him out, and he's like, I'm not touching this thing. Like, yeah, I'm a mechanic, but no. Like,
wait, like, what do you do when you're in the air?
Well, no, like, they're on the runway, but, like, it was like, geez, man. Like,
that's asking a lot. I don't think I'd raise my hand for that one.
No, I think he did raise that. He's like, I'm not working on it. Like, I think he wanted to look at it. Like, it was something like a hose or something. He's like, I can't like dive into this thing. I can't remember what they ended up doing.
You know what was crazy? Like, this is one of the things I actually looked into a while ago. In World War II, the flight engineers. I always heard the term like flight engineer. I'm like, oh, flight engineer. It just meant flight mechanic. They used to put mechanics on like the B-17.
Oh yeah,
because they'd get shot up and they'd be like repairing these planes like midair.
You'd get a little box of tools and some duct tape and say, "Make her happen, man."
Yeah, too bad they didn't have Flex Seal then.
Yeah, long before Flex Seal.
I mean, I don't think it mattered when you looked at like those old. That's the one thing, because like I hate flying like commercial and the big plane, and all I can think of, I'm like, okay, if in the 1940s. These things could lose an entire wing with flak. I'm pretty sure these new planes are okay for turbulence.
Yeah, they're going to take a lot of bouncing before you're in trouble. I hate flying commercial, though. I almost won't do it anymore.
Really? That scares me. I'm about to fly out here.
I just don't like it. I'd rather fly. I'd like to fly myself. I'm spoiled.
If I meet you somewhere, will you fly me down to Arizona? Maybe in North Dakota.
It'll be a long flight, I'll tell you that. We'll really get to know each other well.
But I mean, it's the physics for me. Like, I know that like a giant Boeing, it needs to be doing like 300 kilometers an hour to stay airborne, which means that if it goes slower than 300 kilometers an hour, it stops staying airborne and starts coming down. It doesn't have enough wind speed to keep itself in the air. Like, that means that if it loses something and it hits the ground, that big commercial airline is hitting the ground at like 300 kilometers an hour. I know that like these tiny little prop planes can stay airborne at like 30, 40 kilometers an hour.
Well, like, you ever see those videos of like those little planes where it's really windy and they're just sitting in the same spot?
No, yeah, that was the Stoll airplanes. Like, we always had a joke when we were in flight school and stuff, Cessna 150s, they're the littlest airplane Cessna makes now, or used to make anyway. If we had about a 40-mile-an-hour wind, you could fly it backwards.
that's sketchy. Just blowing it in the wind. You're just a paper bag up there.
Yeah, you just pull the motor all the way down, you drop the flaps, and you just hang it right above the stall speed, and then you'll watch the ground actually go the opposite direction. It's pretty.
Have you ever seen the ones with like the giant tires they put on them?
Oh yeah, those are the Stoll aircraft, the bush planes.
Yeah,
you gotta land anywhere, Shane.
those make me feel totally fine about flying because I'm like, oh, you know what?
If we lose all our power,
yeah, we'll just come like face the wind and we'll just come down like a helicopter. I'm fine with that. I don't want to come down at 200 kilometers an hour. I'm not as okay with that.
It's funny, actually. There's a guy in our area. I can't remember his name. I'm gonna feel bad if anyone hears that knows him. But he was up north fighting a bushfire, like way back when, and he was just circling the fire area, and there was a dozer operator stuck down there, and there was a little spot for him to land, and he landed down there and pulled him out of there, and that cat like burnt to crisp, and everything around him did. So the guy got out of there, but he had one of those little planes with those big tires and scooped him up.
I'll be damned.
Mm-hmm. Scary, sketchy.
One of these days, I'm going to build one of those planes. I haven't gotten that. Right now, the goal is to build a new 4-seat airplane that flies very fast. So we can go see my wife's family in Kansas easier.
That's the nice thing about owning a plane. You could just like, yeah, now you're going to go for a trip over to the, you know, a few hours away. Like if I had a plane, I'd be, oh, Chase, see you in a few hours. Like,
yeah, well, right now they're about a 6-hour drive. And in the plane I got right now, we can cut it down to about 2.5, 3. And we'd like to go a little faster.
Mm.
So how does that work when you have a plane? Because like I am completely ignorant. Can you just hop in your plane and fly to any airport, or do you have to like call the airport you're going to in advance and be like, hey, can I come over and land in your airport?
Just go.
Yep,
you just go, you just hop in your plane, turn the key, like just like
you have to call
in
though,
like when you get to the airport, you jump on there, it's like the radio station for the airport, and you just basically call out to the world, you know, I'm November 246 and I'm coming in to land on runway 14. So that way everybody in the area goes, oh, yeah, hey, somebody's coming. Let's pay attention.
Okay. How does that work, like, to know what airports you're allowed to land at and which ones you're not? Like,
well, you can land at just about any of them.
So you can go into, like, military.
Yeah, as long as it isn't military airspace. But, like, commercial airspace, like, if you're going to a big airport, then you got to talk to the tower, and they have to give you permission then. So if it's a commercial airport, like, you know, Southwest or American Airlines, is all of them are flying in and out of, there's a control tower and there's a guy or a group of people sitting up there that are dictating when planes come in and out.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah, so those big airports, yeah, when you're like 25 miles out, you'll make first contact or so with them, and they'll get you on radar.
If you're coming in with a Cessna, like your little C-150, or
you
can't call into LAX and be like, hey, yeah, I'm gonna come in and land.
You actually can. You could call into LAX and say, hey, yeah, I need to land, or I would like to land.
They can just like deny you though, right?
They may divert you to a smaller local airport.
Yeah, but they'll try to work with you.
Yeah, they'll try to work with you.
Wow, hey, that's
you know, I actually, the one part I love about aviation is the people. I mean, it is a really tight knit. Really great group of people that pretty much work in aviation, and the aerial applicators it's even more so, because there's only, I think last I read, was 3,500 aerial applicators in the U.S.
Wow, that's actually more than I thought.
I think that's less. The U.S. is huge.
Yeah, that's nationwide for us. 3,500 is all. So I thought that number's pretty low myself. And it's funny because most everybody knows everybody. So if you piss somebody off, there's a high likelihood that when you try to get a job for someone else, they'd be like, yeah, no, you know, I already talked to, you know, Joe Bob over there, and he said you suck.
Fair.
And it's one of them things. If you're an aerial applicator pilot and you're looking for a job, it's almost amazing. Then that sometimes says something about you. You're either really new or you've pissed a lot of people off.
Are you going to go over to Australia for a season and do some flying there?
I would love to. I think that would be a hoot.
Australia, eh?
I think that'd be a great time because their season's opposite of ours.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, like a lot of Canadian pilots go over there and fly.
Yeah, yeah.
Ken Kane used to get lots of Australians who would come down to fly in, like, yeah, opposite season.
Yep, they do opposite seasons. We got a couple of Aussies that'll show up here.
See, I always thought the forest firefighter pilots.
Ah, that would be cool.
Like the water bombers. That would be the one thing I'd love too. Running a water bomber in the mountains.
There's a lot of flying I'd like to do, because it's all so much fun. It's probably my favorite way to make money right now.
And it's probably not as competitive and cut rate as trucking, I would imagine.
It depends on where you are. Up here, you know, Midwest and North, everybody's pretty good at, from what I'm told. I haven't flown down south. Everybody says down south, things are a lot more cutthroat. Their seasons are longer. There's more operators down there. And it's a whole different attitude down there, apparently. Now, I might be speaking out of turn because I don't know. I haven't been there. That's just the rumors I hear up here in Nebraska. Because around here, everybody's like, yeah, there's a lot of area to go around. So nobody worries too much.
I always like think of like the Yukon and Alaska guys. They must be doing all right.
Yeah, I would bet.
Because like that seems like a fun one. Like just being up in Alaska in a little bush plane. Like I once hauled into a place like that. It was way up in the Nahanni Mountains between the Yukon Northwest Territories. Hauled a load of freight, sat there for 3 days as this little bush pilot. Multiple times a day, he would come in, he'd load up like 500 kgs worth of goods or whatever, and then they'd fly it into this little mining exploration camp, and he'd come back, and like we had like 80,000 pounds on the truck, and it took him like 3 days.
Oh yeah, just little by little.
Yeah, handball, but it was great. They're like,
they had that whole TV show on Discovery, you know, the ice pilots.
Oh yeah, with old Buffalo Air.
Yeah, old Buffalo Air. I watched that quite a few episodes of that. That was pretty entertaining.
Losing his like permission from like the FAA or whatever the Canadian keep flying because of the show.
Canadian Transport or whatever.
I'm not sure.
I can't remember what they call it up there because they don't have Canada doesn't actually have like the U.S. has FAA. Canada doesn't have that. It's all Transport Canada.
Yeah, it's that's the weird thing is like the same people that look after the airlines look after the trucks.
Yeah, where we see how bad the roads are. And then we have the FAA, and we have like different government agencies specific for this thing up in Canada. You guys are like, nah, we take care of it all. We look at
the ground. We also don't have a lot of people here.
I kind of like the way we do it rather than having like a million. The U.S. confuses me every time I look up rules and regulations. They're like, why is there like six different branches for like just the trucking industry has like six different government organizations with like a million different abbreviations. Like Canada's just like, oh yeah, you got Steve at Transport Canada to go talk to him.
We have one truck at work and the place I'm contracting with right now, and it has a Georgia safety sticker on it. It's like, why do we need that? It's like, because you need one to the truck in there. You can't go in there without it. And I was like, are you serious? Like, what? They got their own rules and laws there. I'm like, what?
Yeah, every state is different in the U.S. as well. They all have their own little idiosyncrasies that you have to comply with. And it is a pain in the butt in the trucking industry. And a lot of it has to do with trucking's big money. You know, there's a lot of corporate haulers in the U.S.,
but I mean, it's big money here too, but we just kind of got together and said that all provinces have the same rules for what the trucks are allowed to do. Like you have the little different things, but
again, I think it's got to do with our population because there's no one up here. Think about it. Chase knows like one person in Manitoba and I know him as well.
That's probably what it was. We made the rules in like the 1960s when there was like five people. And you're you take an area like, oh yeah, you're the Northern BC. Just so you know, you're going to be the transport guy. You're like the transport guy. Yeah. Yeah. You live up in Whitehorse and you just monitor the transport, the planes, the trucks,
everything.
The
taxis, you just do it all.
Yeah. We're just going to have one guy. His name's going to be Brian. That's just going to be the transport guy for the Yukon. You need anything? Like, that's probably literally how it was.
Yeah, we hit the 2000s. Like, maybe we should give Brian another guy. Yeah, okay, there's two transport guys.
Yeah, I got rid of his brother who was doing the air care and tire service.
That's funny. I'm actually in a small town. Well, I'm from a small town, but I'm in Pangbin, Saskatchewan right now. And there's a little co-op here. And, yeah, it's got tire, hydraulic hoses. Then it's got a little bit of food in it. It's got everything.
Yeah, it's the whole 9 yards.
Whole shebang here.
Oh, I miss those kind of stores.
They're the best.
we have way too many like corporate stores now where it's like it just covers like everything, like the giant chains, and the people inside know nothing. That guy that runs like the entire food store, like I guarantee you, it is always like an older guy at the counter. You can go in there with any part, anything you need, and he just knows immediately what it is, and he knows who in town has that spare part. He's like, oh yeah, I know Roy. Roy's got a tractor that'll match that year of tractor. He's just got a parts one. Go run down. He might have it for you. And you're like, oh, yeah. Thanks.
It was the thing is, you'll ask for Roy's number. Well, Roy don't have a phone, but he's he's usually at the house between 3 and 7. Just exactly. Wait at the end of the drive.
No, it was ridiculous today because I walk in and the guy's literally got lotto tickets like under like the sale area where he sells his tickets. He got a little bit of food. And so the little store's like, hey, like, you got any hydraulic fittings? He's like, well, do you need to hold it out? He's like, okay, so it's got JIC, we have a flat face, and then goes to ORB. Wow, this is a mess. And we go to the back, start going through fittings. I was like, geez, okay, knows his stuff. Also, that fitting was a mess. It had 3 different types of fitting within one little transition. My. It was ridiculous. I was quite mad. I told him to cut it out, and we just put in JIC everywhere. But it was like short hose fitting, and it was just ridiculous.
That there's the nice part about aviation is everything's kind of a military standard. So like all U.S. airplanes are SAE, all simple. You know, we don't have a bunch of crazy different fittings for everything. Everything's an AN fitting, and all the bolts are standard fine thread.
Well, that's the way trucking and like trucks and equipment used to be up until the 1980s. All the manufacturers had to listen to U.S. military spec because they were super worried about the Soviets, the Russians.
Yeah. Well, we had to be able to change over from, you know, building mom's shopping van to a tank tomorrow.
Yeah. And they also wanted the spare parts. So it was you need to be able to manufacture all the military things. And then what they noticed is what we did to the Germans, World War II. We took a bunch of planes in the air. We bombed the hell out of their factories, crippled their ability to produce anything as a way to win the war. Yep. And then they're like, well, what's going to happen is if we go to war with all these intercontinental missiles, Russia's going to target our factories. They're going to target like Detroit, that Rust Belt, where we make everything. Well, now all of a sudden we have a nuclear war, a massive exchange of powers. It's going to be decided in a few hours. How are we going to recover from having our factories wiped out? They said trucking is so important because people will literally start starving to death. Those that survived the initial war will start starving to death if the trucks can't deliver. And if we lose our factories, we can't make parts for the truck. Therefore, all the trucks need to have the same parts, the same fittings, so we can take any part off of any truck and throw it into any other truck. And that's why you see like a Type 30 brake pot on a commercial truck has been the same since the 1950s till today. You would see the same BorgWarner turbo on a Cummins or on a Cat or on it was all just that same turbo. We kept that until basically the fall of the Soviet Union. They were like, well, we don't need to worry. We'll relax these standards. Manufacturers can build whatever you want. And now you got, you got a 2014 Kenworth. Yeah, I know that turn signal is also off a 2014 Kenworth, but you have the high beam switch in yours and he doesn't. Therefore, the plug won't work and the mounting is different. So you got to find it. Like it killed the parts industry.
Oh, it destroyed. Oh, well, you got to remember all the politics that happened in the 1980s. And the old guys from World War II were, you know, moving out of power and the younger generation was moving in. And money was very important. And it's always cheaper to make things overseas somehow.
Yeah, I've always blamed that. And it's my probably most controversial opinion I have on the whole thing. But I always blamed cutting the corporate tax rate. I think that's the one thing that screwed us.
Oh, 100%. Because it took away incentive for them to do stuff.
Yeah. Well, it used to be like we'd have a 60, 70%, 80% corporate tax rate. And a lot of people said, well, that's not good because then the businesses, like, if we cut the tax rate, businesses will then have more money. So they'll be more incentivized to spend more and develop more. And it's such a backwards way of thinking because then nobody thought it through. You're like, tax, you only pay tax on profit.
Yeah.
That means the money that you
have. There's a couple people through very well.
Oh, yeah. But they sure sold that story to everybody that if we have low corporate tax rate, it'll be a boom for the economy. No, it was a boom for the people that owned the large corporations, but man, did everybody else suffer.
Well, you could tell right where all the wealth started changing hands was right in that 80s area where the corporate tax dropped to, you know, next to nothing.
Yeah.
And if you don't force people to do stuff, they won't.
But in the corporate tax break, I'm chasing, not arguing, it's disgusting. Yeah. But like it's for those giant, like for the giant companies. Hell yeah, but for like it's got to be scales. And I think they should just do more incremental scales. Because like, you know, mom and pop making 80 grand a year, you don't tax them 60% just because they're incorporated.
You'll never hit that tax rate. If you look up at what the scale was, when you hit like that 94% tax rate or that 70% tax rate, the amount of money was so high, it never would have touched a mom and pop shop. If you're a mom and pop shop making that kind of money, you were doing super well and it didn't matter.
Mm. Yeah, you were literally flying for, well, if you were a mom and pop shop making that kind of money, you weren't declaring that money on your taxes. That's all I'm going to say where that money was coming from in the 70s. She was coming straight out of Columbia. That's the only way a mom back then was making that money.
Yeah, they called it a laundering business, I believe.
But that's how it was. There was a corporate tax rate that scaled, and it gave some small mom and pops way better because – like, Ma and Pa, you made under $400,000 or $300,000 a year. Like, with your small business, you paid, like, 10% tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
You made, like, $1 million, you paid, like, 25. You made $10 million, you paid 40.
Mm-hmm.
You
so made, this, like, this is how this was million dollars at that point.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Yeah, that's how it was previous to the 80s.
Dang.
Which gave a huge incentive to small Ma and Pa's businesses because Ma and Pa businesses had a much better tax. Like, you're a small business, you don't need to pay the same taxes that Walmart does, which it also incentivized businesses to grow a lot more because when you got to a larger scale, there's two ways that you could cash out of your business. You could sell your shares and your equity, or you could take a lot of profit as you ran the business. With a large, high corporate tax rate, instead, you would try and cash out. Let's grow this business to the biggest we possibly can. And then that'll be the retirement thing. Like, let's grow a strong business.
Mm-hmm.
So what you would do is, let's say at the end of the year, you had a good year. You had $100 million in the bank in profit. You would look at that $100 million and you say, well, if I give it to the government, I'm only going to be left with $10 million and the government's going to take $90 million. Instead, wouldn't it make a lot more sense if I spent that $100 million or that $90 million? I'll spend that $90 million. I'll build a new factory. I'll start producing a lot more. And then that puts my profit at $10 million. That puts me in the lower tax rate bracket. Therefore, I'm basically out of that $10 million, keeping $8 million. So I could spend $90 million, build a new factory, and be left with $8 million in profit. Or I could do nothing, and I could sit on that money and be left with $10 million in profit. Well, a lot of people are said, let's build a new factory, let's get things going. That's going to increase the stock price. That's going to be fantastic. It's a bigger dick wagon competition with my rival companies that I built another factory. And what that did is it incentivized a ton of production in the US and Canada.
Well, it not only incentivized production, it incentivized wages increase because an easy expenditure for a business was to raise wages. Employees cost money, so we can expense that.
No wonder you could have in the 60s, you could have a dad that worked in a machine shop and he could have two cars, a cottage, a house.
Well, I mean, it was at the point like in the 60s and 70s, you could work at McDonald's and own a house.
Yeah.
Like that minimum wage actually covered living. Huh. It's unreal, but I mean, it sounds crazy today. And I always, that whole political world that'll drive me crazy, but
well, I always use the cost of a Camaro.
Yeah,
what cost of a Camaro? I'm just gonna Google. It's like I'm like facts right in. When did they come out? 1967.
Yeah, right in there.
Cost of a Camaro.
Mustang was 64 and a half, and the Camaro was like 3 years later.
Okay, yeah. In the debut, you would spend about $4,000 in it. Now, let's look up minimum wage. 1967. Minimum wage in 1967 was $1.25. So you take $4,000 for the Camaro?
Yep.
Divided by 1.25 meant you could buy a top-of-the-line Camaro with 3,200 hours. Divided by that by 40 hours a week means 80 hours of work at minimum wage. Divided by 52 weeks a year, 1.5 years, and you can buy a Camaro.
Yep.
Now, a new Camaro, brand new Camaro, you're looking at about $85,000 for a top-of-the-line Camaro. Actually, I think it's like $95,000.
I don't think you actually can't buy a Camaro anymore. I think they discontinued them again.
Oh, they did again?
Yeah, they did again. Well, see, this was another
say
thing
it's 95.
But the last time I remember looking at it, 95 for a top of the line.
For the number, just say 95.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's right in there. It was like a, you know, $90,000 car, $80,000 car for a top of the line.
I just want to hear the math. Get on it. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Now it's sorry, Jason. $14.50 for minimum wage now.
Mm-hmm.
That means you need to work 6,500 hours, divide that by 40 hours per week, 106 divided by 52 weeks a year, means that you now have to work 3.5 years to buy the same car that you did minimum wage. So the cost of to actually buy something has more than halved.
Also, you add on everything else, it's gone nuts. Sorry to cut you off there, Jace. I just needed to hear the end of this rant.
I wanted to figure out what the exact math was there, looking at that. So, yeah, it is literally.
Well, here, see, and this is even worse one, guys. You said it's 14 an hour. See, in the U.S., we're still like 7.25.
Mm-hmm.
That's seven. Federal minimum wage in the U.S.
Okay, well, let's look up 80,000.
That would just double the number.
It's basically double.
Yeah,
just double,
yeah, double the number. So, yeah. Let me try.
50 to 7.25. Jeez.
Okay. So, yes, it's 7 years then. So, 7 years mm-hmm. to buy the same car that you could have bought in a year and a half.
Yeah. It's just insane. See, and that's another one we're battling in the aviation industry because right now we're running on a huge shortage of pilots and mechanics. Like the average age for an aviation mechanic in the U.S. is like 58 or 59 years old.
Oh, goodness.
They say 20% of the maintenance industry in the U.S. is over age 65. Yeah, so like any day, if they just all decided to retire, we'd lose 20% of our aviation mechanics.
Right. Because for some reason, a large part of our parents' generation were like, you all need to go to university, get a good job, like everybody. And the problem is that it's like a tragedy of the commons. Everybody wanted their kid to become that doctor, that engineer, that, you know, be the guy in the office. Because everybody back in the 60s working in the factory would look at the guy in the office and be like, I want my kid to be that guy in the office, not this guy, you know, running the drill press.
I'm going
to
save $2,000 and send my boy to college.
For our generation, like, you know, I'm 38 now, so everybody my age was, you know, told go to school, go get a 4-year degree. Because all of our parents lived through the 80s and the early 90s where they watched the, you know, standard job at, you know, your meatpacking plant. Everybody got replaced. And the wages started to stagnate. So the only people that were making money were the white-collar jobs. So you told all your kids, go get a white-collar job and you'll be able to make a living. And then, you know, after everybody's going to college, well, colleges didn't take long to figure that out. So then they started jacking tuition and they just keep moving the goalpost.
Yep. And now we're losing the white-collar jobs too.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody in this
people got a bunch of CERB for 2 years and they're like, hey, we can just stay home. This is awesome.
Well, I really believe that the worst thing that happened with COVID that's happened to like all these college jobs, and they know what they were doing, but it's COVID. We'll all work from home. Everybody can work remotely. And everybody was saying, this is fantastic. Everyone's allowed to work from home, work remotely. You know what? All these large companies really figured out, and you see it a lot now, is that, hey, you know what? They are working remotely from home. I don't need to hire a guy that lives in San Francisco to work from home. I can hire a guy in Bangladesh to work remotely and he'll work for $1 an hour to do this same accounting work that I was paying this guy working remotely for $35 an hour domestically. They outsourced the white collar jobs during COVID. During COVID, they outsourced all the white collar jobs the exact same way in the 1980s. We outsourced the manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Me and you were talking about, you were trying to do the idea of getting a white collar job and then hiring someone to do all your work if you got a work from home job and just hiring someone through Fiverr or something to do your job.
Now you know the whole world of middle management, because you had upper managers that don't want to do the work, so they hire middle managers to do all the work that the upper management's supposed to do. So there's always that tree climbing deal where somebody's trying not to work. You know, I always laugh when everybody goes, nobody wants to work no more. Nobody's ever wanted to work.
No,
I don't know anybody that ever wants to work. We just want to have stuff. And unfortunately, there's only one way to get it.
Did you ever see my TikTok video about my elaborate work from home scam that we ran there for a while?
Yeah.
And Jordan was saying about it. Did you ever see that there, Jace?
I don't think I've seen that one. That one might not have been up on my For You.
So what I broke it down. You would take about 3-4 jobs that would be paying about $25 an hour that would work from home. And as a truck driver, you have a lot of time during the day to like sit and manage phone calls. So when you're driving the truck, all you would do is you would take these jobs. They would give you a work assignment. You would then go on Fiverr, hire a guy in Bangladesh to do the work for you. And he would work for like $5 an hour, because that's an amazing wage over there. Like the average annual salaries, monthly salary is like $300. You give someone like $5 an hour. He's like, absolutely, does amazing work. So then your boss would then, as you're working this job for like $25 an hour remotely, you would answer the calls. You would be the face. You would take the work package and you'd relay the information to the guy from Bangladesh who would actually do the work. And therefore, while you were driving the truck or sitting at home in an office, and I knew like a few people that did this, they would sit at home, have 4 different full-time jobs. They would do like 2-3 hours of meetings per day and then relax and then take 4 times the salary. So they would contract out to different companies working remotely and then hire somebody abroad. And it was the same way. It's like, well, we can do this because guarantee the companies and these corporations are going to figure this out within like a year or two. They're going to do it. We might as well do it now before they do.
The only flaw in the whole plan is the quality control, because you can't guarantee the guy in Bangladesh does actually do that good of a job.
No, you can. I mean, you do have to check it over. But what's going to happen? You get fired from that job? You've got three other ones on the back burner.
Well, they did that years ago. They did that with all the telephones. You know, whenever you called into a customer service, it was always like, I'm Ken from Missouri. And you're like, nah, no, you're not. You're not from Missouri.
See, I always said the old truck drivers, because you see a lot of Indian truck drivers. That's 100% where you were getting on the call sign, because every time you see them, they got those big headsets on. Mm-hmm. That's what those truck drivers are doing. They're running the call center.
They're running the call center right from the truck.
Yeah. Why not? Hey, you got all the time in the world. You're just sitting there. You might as well talk to people. Out. Yeah. And then they're like, they always transfer me to somebody else instead of fixing the problem. It's like, yeah, they can't fix your problem because they're doing 60 mile an hour down the interstate.
See, and that's just working more efficient.
Yeah. That's where you got to do it. Yeah. You're running that call center. You're hitting the buttons. You're like, okay, I just need to transfer you to our different collections department. Transfer it to Buddy getting the other way on the interstate.
See, now you're working 80 hours a week on the paycheck, but you're only doing 40. That's the plan.
See, that's how you got to do it. You got to outsource. you got to outsource those jobs.
See, then this is why I sit in an airplane, because it's really hard to outsource that job.
Don't they have autopilots and like remote controls? I guarantee you,
the drone industry is trying to come, and they're the most annoying things right now, because you can't exactly autopilot what we do. I mean, you kind of could, but there's a lot of stuff that happens like right now. And you got to be on the stick for.
Yeah. The drone thing, though, I know what they're going with is the efficiency of the spray, is they can just spot and do spot plots.
Yeah, it doesn't work as well as they like to sell it to you.
That's just like everybody's got their
angle on their I'm just waiting for the government to support it, because if the government supports something, I find it's usually wrong.
Well, it's
just
not
kidding. It's not always wrong. It's always wrong. It's not always wrong.
You have to wait until there's enough money in it that a corporation wants to lobby to get a law passed for them to be able to do it.
When we're changing the laws, then
drones are sweet. I drones definitely do have their place, though.
They do. Some of them do. But like for what we're doing, you know, even up like in Manitoba, these are 2 mile long rounds up where you guys are. For us, it's a quarter mile stuff, but we're doing 160 acres, 200 acres at a shot. It'd take a pretty big drone to do that.
Yeah. And another issue we deal with, especially here, is uncontrollable weather. It is terrible. Like I would have a little drone flying. Well, I guess you wouldn't be spraying in bad weather. But that's the thing. We spray in a lot of bad weather because we always have bad weather. Like even if it is windy, sometimes the guys still go out and have to go lower. Like how would the drones handle that? They're so light.
No. And you know,
couldn't you just put the drones software in like a full size plane?
Kind of. I mean, some stuff scales, some stuff doesn't. Right now, it doesn't all scale. If you gave a guy a huge budget and tell him to figure it out, they would. But right now, it's not cost effective because it's still a small industry. Like I said, aerial application's not a big industry. So, and right now, what they're trying to sell drones on is they're trying to sell it to farmers saying, hey, you could do it yourself. Well, the more farmers I know, and this ain't all of them, but there's a lot of them, they don't want to do it themselves. They're already calling the co-op to spray their fields from the ground rigs. They don't want to own all that equipment.
Yeah, and it's expensive equipment to own. Plus, it's not the best application for drones, because every time you put a drone to spray a field, that's one less drone that I can see footage of bombing a tank in the Ukraine.
Like, there it is.
Like, well, I want to see more trick shots from drones. That's all I'm saying.
Have you been watching a lot of those, Chase?
Oh my god, yes.
They're pretty crazy.
Do you see the one where they like they drop it through the sunroof of like a moving car?
That one is nuts.
I know it's like people dying. I mean, like it shouldn't, but like whatever. If you don't want to die from a drone, get out of the Ukraine, Russia. Like, there's a simple way to solve this one. They're like, you can't feel bad. You got to feel bad for those people that are getting killed by the Ukrainian drones. I'm like, they could just leave, like, leave the Ukraine and you'll stop getting killed.
Yeah. You know, when you're not wanted in the first place of being there, don't go there. It's really easy.
I have as much sympathy for the Russians getting hit by a drone as I do from a guy that, like, pulls out a handgun and gets shot by the cops. They were like, well, maybe you shouldn't pull the handgun on the cops and you'd be alive. I have zero sympathy for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of it's simple thinking. If you don't put yourself in that situation, you'll probably be okay. But it's the easiest stuff some people just can't understand.
Yeah.
But see, our biggest problem with the drones is the regulations on it. Like all the stuff that we do with airplanes, everything's regulated. Like parts, the manufacturing, everything has to be certified, checked over by the FAA. And the drone world, they're not doing that. Like, there's no certified drone mechanic. You know, they just recently kind of got certified pilots. And, you know, that's if and kind of crazy. So it's all the regulations that they're not having to follow that the airplane industry does, which is kind of ridiculous. It's either they need to lower our regulations or up theirs. Because like I couldn't even put in like an aftermarket air conditioner in my airplane unless it's certified.
Really?
Yep. You can't just go like even LED lighting sometimes. It's like, oh no, you want to change your cockpit lighting? Well, that wasn't approved. That's not what the manufacturer did. You can't do that.
Really?
Uh-huh.
So yours having a different motor in it, that's got to be pretty hard to do then. No.
There's a company, it was called Cascade. Back in the early 2000s, we're doing this, and they had to go to the FAA, and they got what they called an STC. It was a supplemental type certificate. So it was a whole approval process to get this engine on this airplane. And it worked out. They sold it because at the time, the exchange rate to the Czech engines was really good. So you're buying turbine engines pretty cheap. And you could retrofit these old radial airplanes with a turbine engine and make them more productive for less money than it costed to go buy a new turbine airplane. So it was a cost effective. It didn't last long once the exchange rate kind of took a dump. And then, you know, our money wasn't worth so much over there. It kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was great. And that company took the effort to work with the FAA to get it all approved. And that's what has to happen. That's why.
I wonder how many pockets got lined for that.
How many what?
Pockets got lined for that.
You know what? Not always. It's funny because the FAA and the aviation industry isn't always lining pockets. Sometimes a lot of it's who you know.
But how well do you know him? Oh, I kind of know this guy. Yeah. I know you better for an extra few grand.
I'm sure there may be some of that going on. Yeah. But a lot of it that I've been involved with, it's just you have to know the right people to talk to who have enough ambition that they actually want to do something.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's government job. They know what they're going to get paid from now until they retire.
Well, that's what they try to get the extra money for. Hey. Sorry, I'm in a shared house here for work, so I got to cut her down here soon. So we're going to go to the final questions.
Oh, okay.
I was going to ask you your favorite dream truck, but I think I should ask you your dream plane or helicopter.
Both. Ooh, dream plane, both. Then dream helicopter. No, dream. Money is no object.
Yeah, you don't have to buy this one to fix it for the farm.
yeah. As far as you get, you got a blank check to buy anything in the world.
The dream helicopter would probably be the Magnum PI helicopter. I'd love to own one of them little MD-500s. I think it'd just be a riot. They're a little hot rod. And a dream airplane. It's hard because there's so many different categories because you could have single seat, you know, warbird stuff. Because like F4U Corsair would be really awesome to own.
F4U Corsair. I gotta Google that too.
They're really all sweet, right. World War II.
Airplane. Oh yes. Yeah. I know what you're. Yeah. No, absolutely.
They sound terrifying.
That is pretty dope. They're looking.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, I absolutely that. Jordan, we might as well go around here. Your helicopter and plane.
Oh my, I don't know that much. My helicopter, I don't know, because I want to be realistic.
Just don't say R22.
Well, I'm not going to do an R22. I just Googled that one from Magnum PI. I was looking at those when I was dream shopping. That is pretty sweet. I'd piggyback on that. And then definitely an old bomber. I don't know my old bomber as well, but definitely an old bomber of sorts. I don't know what I'd do with it, but damn, that'd be cool.
Like a B-29 or something?
Yeah, something like that would just be, I don't know what you do with it, but God, it'd be cool to have.
Like an old B-17, like Flying Fortress.
I'd definitely get someone to drive it and walk around.
That's definitely mine. I want an old B-17 Flying Fortress. Like, if I ever make enough money for have, like, a private jet, like, I'm not going to be in, like, a Learjet.
Yeah. Because
you know what? Any dickhead can land in Monaco in a Learjet. I want to come in with a B-17 and a couple of P-51 Mustangs out on each wing.
I want just four radial engines just redlined.
And... exactly. Yeah.
And you want the lower gunner, too.
You got to have the ball gunner.
That's a must.
Like that, I'm sorry, but like, as far as I'm concerned, any billionaire is screwing it up when he lands. And you're like, you know, I get it, they're using it for convenience, but like, all these people that buy a private jet for like the luxury option, they're like, oh, it's so nice. No, you're doing it wrong. I'm sorry, but if I'm arriving in Monaco and I want to make a big show of it, like I'm, you know, some Middle Eastern,
you're more
guy
of a Harrison Ford then kind of guy,
yeah,
where you just got it, he's got his own de Havilland Beaver and. Just 3 tons of different aircraft.
What's that plane from The Expendables? That one's pretty sweet.
Oh, I got
no idea.
I don't know that one, actually.
It's just sweet because how rough it is. I don't know if it's actually a good plane or not. It's just the way he beats it up.
I have to Google that one.
Like the water bomber?
It doesn't look as cool as I remember it being from the movie.
I think that's just a water bomber, man. Yeah, that's just a water bomber.
No way. No.
The Groom and Albatross?
In the new, is it the second or third Expendables? I swear there's a different one. I can't find it.
Oh, that just looks like a Dash 8 kind of thing. That's just a Dash 8. You can get one of those at frickin' Air Canada Jazz and fly in one of those. That's not a cool plane.
No,
that's a plane that's doing the daily run between like Fort St. John to Prince George.
I cannot find the one I'm looking for here.
I'm not seeing it.
I'm going to rewatch the movie.
You could have picked any plane in the world. Jordan picks a Dash 8 from Air Canada.
Hey, you gotta have dreams, man.
You gotta dream big. Dream big.
I can't find the plan. This is not the one I'm thinking of. Don't rip on me yet. This is not it.
All right, we'll hop into the final question here. What is the stupidest job you've ever done? Not like the stupidest job, like career-wise, but like what task have you ever been given as an airplane mechanic where you're just like, oh my God, why am I doing this?
Oh, God, what was that? I gotta think here for a minute. I know there's been a couple of dumb ones that I've had to do. I've had, like, one of the dumbest ones I've had to do was take tape and mark the screws. Like, they're called quarter turn fasteners, and the heads would have to be in a certain orientation. So I had to mark them with tape so that way you could look at it and see if the screw is in the right orientation.
As opposed to just looking at the screw?
And opposed to just looking at the screw. It had to line up with the marks. That way you knew it was tight.
Oh, my. Yeah, that one would be annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of them.
Fair enough. You know, I got to say, like, thanks for coming on. You were one of the first people I ever really followed on TikTok.
Really?
Yeah, you're definitely one of the first people I ever followed on TikTok, where, like, I remember, like, opening TikTok, and it was, like, you were one of the first people that came up, and it was your cowboy advice videos.
And yeah, like, I had the cowboy advice and all the cowboy poetry. I've been meaning to get back to it. Last year was just so crazy. I haven't put a video out, I think, since harvest.
Yeah, it was your cowboy advice and your cowboy poetry. You were one of the first people I ever followed on TikTok. And I'm like, I love this cowboy advice. I'm like, everything else I had seen on TikTok was all like people dancing and these stupid videos. And I'm like, it reminded me of like the old like Red Seagull.
Oh, yeah. Red Seagull. Cowboy Corner.
Yeah, it reminded me. I'm like, that's Red Seagull's Cowboy Corner on TikTok. I'm like, I love this cowboy advice. So you were like one of the first people I like followed and went down it.
No, I remember seeing your login video show up, and then you announced that Edison Motors. And when I seen that, started seeing you guys, what you're doing with that. I threw some money in. I got the jacket. And been watching ever since.
Oh, no way. You were one of the first round investors.
I'm one of the first round investors.
Wow.
I'm trying to remember if I filled out a form for a Jace Bender.
I've got the coat sitting here in the hangar.
There were so many names.
Oh, oh yeah, I bet. Was, yeah,
what was the best? Case, what
there was
the best
only
name
like 100
there?
People that got jackets. Or no, there was like 200. I think I got like 140 jackets or something like that. So there wasn't a lot of the jackets.
Sorry, Bartholomew Bendick. The best name of people we had to sell to. A dude's name was Bartholomew Bendick.
Damn.
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say his name, but that is the coolest name out there I've ever heard.
No, I remember you guys put out that first round, and I watched your video, and I sat there, and I thought that night. He's like, you know what? I've thrown a lot of money at some dumb things, but this actually sounds like a good cause.
So, it's cool to know you're invested.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the investment's doing pretty good right now, so.
It looks pretty awesome. I when you guys were going to show the prototype, I was like, God, I wish I could go out and see it.
Well, we're just raising some additional money with some industry partners right now. So there's a couple companies on board. So basically they're buying a truck, but we're partnering up. So they're getting some equity in dealing with it. Cause we want to, like, the first companies are a bit larger companies, and the trucks are going to be a little bit more expensive because they're their first few trucks that we're making. And we wanted a long-term partnership where it's, hey, give us that real world feedback. So we wanted them to invest, but basically they're getting like 0.5% for about $1.5 million.
$1 million
for that 0.5%. But that worked out to a valuation for the company of something like, I think it worked out to like $200 million valuation.
Yeah, that's a
like,
hell of a
was this in the group chat? I don't remember that.
Yes, it was. You're just never in the group chat, Jordan. This is the director's group chat. You are the third largest investor in the company, and somehow you are never paying attention to what is going on in the company.
True.
I think at this point you understand. You pretty much have my proxy. Whatever you say, I'm like, yeah, no, Chase is right. Like, I rarely opposed any idea you've had. So you pretty much have my proxy.
Yeah,
that's enough. Awesome.
Yeah. But
that does put the share, each share at roughly about $40 per share value. I think
that's probably one of the better investments I've ever made.
Well, at $30, because you would have got a jacket. So I'm guessing you got 500 shares.
Yeah. Something like that, I think it was.
At that 500, that means that jacket is probably worth about $20,000 right now, somewhere in that $15,000 to $20,000.
Yeah, that's doing way better than anything else I've got invested.
Yeah, and we are still pretty just like I'd say we're on the just starting phases still. Like we got time.
Hey, that's awesome. I hope you guys just take off. I really do.
Yeah, me too.
It's a great idea. It's one of them. I was actually talking, we were working on the crop duster today, and I told him I was going to be on this podcast, and he says, well, how do you know these guys? I said, well, that jacket sitting there, I said, I invested in their company, and they reached out and want to talk to me. And he says, oh, that's really cool. He's like, so it's kind of like a train, ain't it? I'm like, yeah, kind of what they're
yeah,
doing.
It's pretty well.
Like
yeah, that's exactly what it is.
But to him, he's like, I don't know why anybody else hasn't done that.
Well,
yeah, we don't know either.
That video that Kenworthy went by, it's like, it's just sitting there on the side of the highway because it's out of juice. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we learned more about that since I posted that video.
Really?
Yeah. So we talked to one of the mechanics at Kenworth who reached out, and I'm not saying any names, but
yeah, don't give a guy up.
What happened was is that they charged that thing like 150 kilometers before, and it still said like, oh yeah, no worries. You still have 40 miles of range. Like you still have an extra like 90 kilometers of range, and it died.
Oh,
they didn't, what they did the math on for their range and prediction on this truck wasn't even close. Like,
can you imagine that boardroom meeting next one? Oh,
yeah. I wouldn't want to be sitting in the hot seat on that.
We put $15 million into this and these stupid truckers from BC, blah, blah, blah. Like,
I think it's the most obvious run of like, hey, just so you know, like you could just put a generator in place of those batteries. And the funniest thing is that they came out with this big prototype thing. And like, you have a look at it. It's literally what we did with our first truck, like that 1962 battery boxes on the side, center mounted drive motor into an auxiliary, into a normal set of rear ends is exactly what we did. Like a bunch of hillbilly loggers made the exact same thing and then still figured out how to get the generator in there to charge the batteries with basically a level 4 charger. But like, how did all the engineers at Kenworth come up with the exact same idea as a bunch of loggers up
honestly,
in Canada?
That was really cool to see that they went that route too. I was like, dang, okay.
The battery boxes are like, even look the same. And like, Jesus.
Did they copy some of it?
I mean, we literally showed how we did everything step by step. Oh, yeah. We lost Jace.
Yeah, no, I was just going to, you had a good rant. I didn't want to cut you off. Yeah, we lost Jace. Again, I got to go to bed. I'm going to keep them guys up. Okay, thanks for listening, guys. Have a good night, Chase. Talk to you later.
Yep, catch you later. Bye.
Bye.